The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Crisis Watch. Crisis at the Etihad as City lose to Wolves. Adama Traore with the goals, meaning they now are 8 points adrift. Crisis for Maurizio Pochettino. Spurs humbled at Brighton as Hugo Lloris dislocates his elbow. Crisis for Ole as United get double long-staffed in Newcastle. Crisis for Marco Silva as Everton lose four in a row. Crisis at Celtic as Rangers go top of the Scottish Premiership. And crisis in Germany as seven-goal Bayern lose at home to Hoffenheim. It's been good for some people as well, so we'll cover that to answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, nice to see you.
Hello.
Barney Ronay, hello.
Hi.
Hey, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Should we start at the Etihad then? Manchester City 0, Wolves 2. City have now lost as many games in the last four as in the previous 23. They're 8 points off Liverpool. Barry, you thought Wolves might spring a surprise. You put a pretty penny on it as well. Given that Wolves had only won once all season and played in Turkey on Thursday night, on what were you basing this?
My God, I just had a feeling, and it proved correct. It could easily have been wrong. It wouldn't be the first time, but I suppose before we examine the City crisis, we should give Wolves plenty of credit, which they really deserve. They came with a game plan, they stuck to it, it worked. Other teams have taken on City and had plans, obviously, which haven't gone so well because they've conceded early. And, you know, as Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan until they get a smack in the face or a smack in the mouth. But I think Wolves really deserve that win. Manchester City's defensive shortcomings were shown up again. Nicolas Otamendi is just not good enough to be in the heart of that defence. He made several mistakes, one of which led to a goal. And it's beginning to look like City's neglect in filling that hole during the summer in not getting a replacement for Vincent Kompany could cost them a title. But it was a very good performance by Wolves. Two goals scored in the counter. And Nuno Espirito Santo had his plan. He played Adama Traore at right back, at the start of right wing back. And then later in the game moved him forward, brought Matt Doherty on to sort of help shore up the defence. And it worked to perfection.
Barney, why are you smiling?
Oh, no, just I was being lulled. I mean, Barry's right. You know, Wolves played really well, but it's it's one of those things. There's two things I really like about Guardiola teams: is obviously the bit where they're brilliant and it's beautiful to watch, and then the bit where things start to go wrong, and they always go wrong in the same way. There's a systemic problem. Something in the machine starts to crunch against something else, and suddenly he becomes a fraud because there's the Fraudiola moment happens. Did you see all that the other week when he in the press conference where he
invented the German
family? He's talking about the fraud.
He married a hair dealer.
But that was a great moment because obviously he'd read that online somewhere or in a newspaper. No one had said that to him because you'd pronounce it Fraudiola. He'd obviously read it. Why are they calling me Fraudiola? It's just an amazing moment when he started talking about that. But it's not that he's a fraud. It's that he's, you know, he's got his way. And there's this sort of brilliant arrogance to it. And arrogant in a good way, because that's what makes them really good as well, that they have world-class cover in every position except fellas at the back who do the other stuff. So they're seriously trying to play Otamendi, John Stones, I'd include in that, and Fernandinho, and win everything and win brilliantly and be the perfect team. And yeah, as Barry says, that's not good enough. And it's brilliant fun. It's part of the process. You have to enjoy it. It's part of the parabola of Fraudiola, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Fraudiola is an old woman who runs a B&B in Essen or something, isn't she? So was this
Essen is Sunderland's twin town.
Is that right?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for making me feel welcome.
No, not a problem. Was this you like your tactics, Wilson? Was this a masterclass from Nuno, or was this part of Fraudiola time?
You know, in Star Wars,
you haven't seen Star Wars.
Yeah. I haven't seen all of them.
Okay.
you know, in Star Wars, I felt slightly cheated by, I mean, I know the sequels all fall out of order now, but this sort of repeated trope of the Death Star, this great machine of death,
mm-hmm.
that has this one fatal flaw, and then they build it again, and has the same fatal flaw. Well, that's what Guardiola keeps doing with his teams. They always have this flaw that if you get in behind them, they're incredibly vulnerable, and he never seems to be able to work out a way of playing his beautiful attacking football, the possession football, without having that little glitch that if you can get the two centre-backs, they are, and this has happened at Barcelona and Bayern Munich as well, they do have that vulnerability. So although they are this sort of awesome machine that can beat you 8-0 and will regularly over a season rack up 5s, 6s and 7s, you always have a sense that there is just that tiny chance
to get your X-Wing into and blow up the whole
thing. Yeah, and teams in the last stage of the Champions League have kept on doing it. And I think what was interesting about this game is that, you know, when they lost games last season, you know, the game against Palace was slightly freakish because Palace scored two ludicrous goals. You can't legislate for Anders Townsend hitting a shot on target, never mind into the top corner from 40 yards. But here it was, and it wasn't just the two goals, it was sort of three or four chances earlier than that of mm-hmm. just pop the ball over the top and run in behind Otamendi. And you know, Barry's right about Otamendi. The thing of, you could accept Otamendi's faults, or you could accept him not being quite perfect for that system if it was he struggled with the passing bit of the game, if he was actually good at the winning the ball in the air, marking, tackling, the sort of traditional virtues of a centre-back. But lunging in like that on Raúl Jiménez, for the first goal, allowing Raúl Jiménez to embarrass him with that little nutmeg, it's pathetic. You know, you can't do that at any kind of level.
And he did that twice in the game. First time it didn't lead to a goal, but second time it did. So,
just going back to Jonathan's point, I think it's doubly interesting because Guardiola knows he's not an idiot. It's like Lampard with his not being able to see what's happening behind him. He knows this as much as we do. And he would say that fatal weakness is essential to the strengths and that you can't have one without the other. And he's willing to build his Death Star with that flaw because that's the only way his fighter jets can get out. So you need that. You know, the whole is essential to the strength. So he would say, I'm going to build this brittle machine, knowing that occasionally it will be completely and utterly destroyed by a lone fighter.
And is there no way around? Is there no way? Can you not build a...
Well, most X-Wing pilots aren't good enough to get into the gap.
It's true. All the ones with moustaches get blown up as Luke's flying in.
Or maybe he himself loves the beauty of this frailty, that he creates this thing that's so wonderful and will occasionally crash. Maybe he can't stop himself. Maybe it's a personality flaw that he's drawn to both, you know, Eros and Thanatos.
That line of Cruyff that I think is relevant. Cruyff's talking about goalkeepers. And he, you know, it's way back when he was manager of Ajax back in the 80s. And he was talking about why he always picked Stanley Menzo in goal, even though Menzo was a goalkeeper who would make mistakes, but he was very, very good with his feet. And he said, you know, he was sort of offering his justification for that, which was goalkeepers have this terror of being lobbed from distance because it makes them look stupid. But he's saying, I don't mind if that happens once or twice a season because we will score way more than one or two goals a season by having my goalkeeper playing outside this box. So we've got to get over this idea that what looks stupid is worse than what's effective.
Well, that's exactly what Guardiola said. I think you were there at the Leicester game where they lost 4-0.
Yes, yeah.
The what is tackles moment.
Yeah.
And he said, no, we're not going to stop trying to play the ball out because we will win far more than we lose doing that. And we don't care. That's the way we are. And he did win two Premier Leagues and produce this beautiful team on the back of that by doing exactly that. And so, you know, that by not being afraid to look stupid occasionally, he gets to look really good 90% of the time.
Yeah, although Cruyff was talking about something slightly different, that mentality of there's a risk-reward thing here. I know what the risk is, and I know the risk is we look really stupid because it keeps on happening. However, I still believe rewards are greater. And it's that sort of mentality he's taking in a slightly different realm, but it's that same basic theory of the faith in the philosophy despite its flaws.
So this question from Will potentially you've answered it then. It says, would the panel agree that if strategy is the art of getting more out of a situation than the starting balance of power would suggest, then Pep is a poor strategist? Would they further agree that if the benchmark is the Champions League, Pep has woefully underperformed over the last decade?
Well, he's talking about pragmatism there, being about a one-off situation where you're possibly battling against adversity, not about overall strategy. I mean, in terms of wider strategy, I think Guardiola is pretty good. But yeah, it does keep, when he has to react, possibly to someone who is good enough or has the tools to disrupt his system, that's been his problem in knockout games in the Champions League. And that's also fascinating.
I mean, you know, all coaches, all philosophies, all theories have weaknesses. We now know what Guardiola's is. Doesn't mean he's worse than other people. And in a sense, it's highlighted more because his strengths are so obvious.
Yeah. So the next team that are playing City in the league, who presumably are not as good as them, should they do what Wolves did?
It happened last year. Teams started knocking the ball in behind the fullbacks. Do you remember Chelsea did it? David Luiz sort of howitzer pass in behind, and they beat them 2-0 at Stamford Bridge. And people had started doing it, and suddenly they were, oh, we can get it. And they did change. Guardiola responded. He stopped having both fullbacks push up at the same time. And that changed. They started attacking in different ways further up the pitch. And that was a response to it. So he's not like a total moron who will just say, well, I can't understand what happened here. It's baffling, you know.
Well, and he's maybe sort of slightly hamstrung by the fact that every time he gets a left-back, the left-back breaks down. Yeah, you know, he's Mendy's kind of constant injury problems, you know, have been a problem because they've always sort of been filling in at left-back. I know Cancelo played yesterday, but on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, he can play.
Zinchenko's done okay, though.
Well, you could say winning a league with Zinchenko there in that way is an incredible piece of strategy overcoming the odds. Yeah, well, it's just that he did it so well, we don't talk about it.
Yeah, because Zinchenko is a midfielder. Mm. He did fine, but it's not as he had to sort of learn a position on the hoof.
Barry, Adama Traore is fun, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he's lightning fast. Yesterday's performance was as good as I've seen of him. He does lack end product, and his crossing can often leave a lot to be desired, but you know, he was outstanding yesterday. It's getting consistently good performances out of him seems to be the problem.
And just how happy were the Wolves fans when those, you know, that's part of football, isn't it, just to see just sort of unmitigated joy on a set of football fans was lovely to see.
Well, Wolves are one of those teams that they're generally a pleasure to watch, and they've got exciting players, they've got an exciting manager. Their season has been kind of ropey so far, but you know, I suppose it depends what you want as a fan. Like last season for Wolves was beyond the wildest expectations of their fans. You know, we have various clubs in crisis, which we will talk about at the moment. Manchester United, you know, playing diabolically badly. I was thinking today, you know, who would be a good replacement for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? Marcelo Bielsa, why not? You know, because Leeds fans, while he didn't get them promoted last season and they're having some bad results this season, his teams are great fun to watch. So, yeah, if I was a Wolves fan, I'd be thrilled with life at the moment. And it's not just on the back of that result.
So I was going to say, it's a lovely club to go to as well. I really like Wolves. Great food in the press box.
Oh, really?
People.
It's a nice view from a press box. I was there for the Chelsea game. It's the first time I'd been since the League Cup tie against Darlington in, I think, 2004. And, I was reminded, Molineux just feels like a proper football stadium as well. It's a nice sense of walk from the station. It's just good.
I love the way the team is now compared to what you'd associate with Wolves with as well. I always think of Stan Cullis and the statue at the front, you know. Who's the statue of?
Billy Wright?
Billy Wright, yeah.
Sorry, I thought you'd seen something.
I saw Billy Wright. I love the way
Billy Wright's ghost coming to attack us.
But you know, that team was all about watering the pitch. You know, before you played these fancy foreign teams, and Cullis was obsessed with cowards, and he forced players to play when they were basically dying, and this sort of long ball football. You know, Charles Reap, and now they've got this beautiful Eurozone team, which just plays the most wonderful, modern, frictionless football.
And look, two great wins in a row. Then what, that at City and at Besiktas on Thursday, where Willy Bolly took that injury time goal like a centre forward, didn't he? It just brought it down perfectly, side foot into the corner. So four wins in a row now in all competitions. And that result for City means Liverpool are 8 points ahead, eight wins in a row. They beat Leicester 2-1 at Anfield, left it pretty late. Was that a penalty, Barney?
Well, if it'd fallen over when the contact was made, nobody would really be talking about it. But what happened was the guy... I know, fouled him, made contact with him. He's kind of still felt maybe I'll be able to get the ball. Saw in that instant he wasn't going to be able to because he'd been fouled, and fell over, to make it quite clear he had been fouled. But the reason he wasn't able to get the ball was because his foot had been caught by the other person. If he had just stopped then and said, I can't get the ball, he's just kicked my foot, so I'm going to lose it. Referee, can I have a penalty, please? No one would say, oh, it was a dive.
But do you think that should... players putting their hands up, yeah, much like the classroom, would be quite a nice way of
if he had done
claiming
that, and the referee
fouls.
Said, yeah, I did see that and I heard the contact, I'm going to stop the game and give a penalty here, that would be fine. But he felt he had to fall over to make that point, which doesn't make him a diver because he was fouled, and I think he tried to play on. Sorry, I'm going on about this, but it's such a sort of nuanced, tiny little
yeah,
moment.
I mean, I think you're probably right. I also think that when... like, I agree it's a penalty, definitely. I also think that when your standing leg is the one hit, you do fall over in a slightly funny way. Like, we're sort of conditioned. We understand that, like, you're running, you get hit on your front leg. We know how to fall over in that circumstance. We're sort of practiced in it. Mm-hmm. Even if, yeah, you know, I'm not saying we practice it, but we're used to that scenario. When suddenly you're trying to move your back leg and there's some kind of interference with it, it can often look weird. So, I mean, I'm not even certain he necessarily manufactured the fall. I think it might just be how you go down when your back leg is suddenly...
Well, he's really smart, Manny. I mean, when he's in that position, he knows what could happen is I could get a penalty here.
Yeah. If you see Old Brighton's reaction, he knows he's kicked it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He didn't complain. Also, do you remember it was Manny who played the ball onto the arm of
Sissoko.
Mm. And everybody thought, do you think he did that deliberately? And maybe he didn't, but he's so bright and clever in there. I don't think that makes him a cheat at all. I think he's a brilliant, clever player, and that's the way football is.
Even still, I don't know why Michael Brighton didn't just whack it into row Z. I mean, I know footballers don't like to just boot it out of play, but in the 94th minute, when you've got a point sewn up at Anfield, probably the right thing to do. James Milner, Barry, so cool for that penalty, and his pass for Mane's goal is astonishing.
Yep, just, I suppose, the very definition of a raking pass, isn't it? About 50, 60 yards down the pitch. Slightly helped by the fact that Johnny Evans misjudged the flight of the ball when you perhaps wouldn't expect him to, but yeah, a wonderful assist.
Can we legitimately ask, is this Liverpool's title to lose now, Jonathan?
I mean, it's still early in the season, but like, it's a good thing to have an 8-point lead. I mean, the doubt is that teams who win a string of games at the beginning of the season, there has been a tendency historically that when things go wrong, the wheels can fall off. So,
what, because they're so used to winning and winning that losing is such a surprise to them?
Yeah, I think maybe. So, or maybe just regression to the mean. But, you know, Liverpool in 1991 won their first eight games of the season. And they didn't collapse, but Arsenal reeled them in and won the title. In 85-6, Manchester United won their first 10 games of the season. At this stage, were 9 points clear of Liverpool, the eventual champions, and they did collapse. So, and I guess the comparison with United in 85-6 is mentally the more valid one, in that United was burdened by this great sense of pressure that they hadn't won it for, whatever time, 18 years. So
you could draw a parallel.
Yeah, I mean, this squad's not going down Paddy Craven's pub every Tuesday and like on a massive bender. So that probably help as we get towards Christmas.
Barney, how do we think Brendan Rodgers acquitted himself on his return to Anfield? I didn't feel
It was mentioned enough in the build-up.
Brendan who? There's some connection there? I think Brendan Rodgers is a really good manager. It's just he didn't, in his first spell at Liverpool, he didn't, at times he was slightly cartoonish and there were the sort of Shankly stylings and the slight theatricality to it. But as he says himself, he was very young then and looking back thinks, my God, how on earth did I manage that? He's often accused of only having nearly chased down the title because he had Luis Suarez, but people forget that he helped make Luis Suarez incredibly. Suarez wasn't like that when he came to Liverpool, and Rodgers had a part in that. He's a really good manager, and clearly Leicester are going to be a lot of fun to watch. I hope they can keep hold of him for at least another couple of seasons.
To Brighton Spurs, Brighton 3, Spurs 0. Barney, you were there. Do we now officially declare the crisis at Spurs a crisis of crisis proportions?
Not in terms of where they are in the season, because, you know, with early doors and all that, but they didn't look very good. And there's something weird about teams when they stop being teams. There's something's been lost there. There's some sort of tension that's gone. I know everybody said, well, you, in fact, said.
What did I say?
7-2. That's the same as 1-0, isn't it? But it's clearly not, you know. And the fact that they conceded a goal within 3 minutes in slightly horrendous circumstances suggests that's the case. I mean, it's quite obvious what's happened with Tottenham. For ages, they overachieved. But it's like a car where you never service it, you never replace anything. Oh, this thing's still going incredibly. You know, I'm speeding down the A40 at 90 miles an hour in my Metro that hasn't been serviced for 5 years. Well, eventually things go wrong at the same time. And there are quite a lot of players in that team who've sort of got old together and probably might have moved on but haven't.
Does it feel like, you know, this is a point where they need to and that this... that. Even though Pochettino is saying, hey, we can use this international break and all get together and fight together, and that's what the players who did speak to the press afterwards said, or watching that, because watching it on TV, it made me think, wow, these guys are, this is bad.
Yeah, they were terrible, really. And it was really interesting seeing them play against the Brighton team who were great and have really good technical players and who completely outpassed and outmoved Spurs. They had this player, Stephen Alzate, who's played 43 career games, 39 of them in League Two, who's from Camden. Is the sort of player who could have slipped out of football. He's a small, technical, skillful midfielder. He absolutely ran the midfield and was brilliant. I've never heard of him or watched him play before. He's in the Colombia under-23 squad. He's been called up by Colombia, and he's been rescued by Brighton, or, you know, something's been spotted in him by Dan Ashworth's there, isn't he, and Graham Potter. And they've got a really good Premier League midfielder there who made Eric Dier look as though he was playing in a suit of armour. I mean, it was, and you know, Eric Dier's an England midfielder. And I thought, I mean, that's the great thing about what they've done there. They look fantastic, and Spurs looked terrible.
And actually, that is similar with Aaron Connolly, right? You know, 19-year-old, first Premier League start, 2 goals. There's something great, I think, about how reputation counts for absolutely nothing. In, you know, the football match starts and you might be some dude from Camden who's played 40 games in League Two, or you might be a 19-year-old on his first start. And you can make established international, not just Dier, but Alderweireld and Vertonghen. I don't know how slow they looked in the flesh.
Oh, really slow. But, I mean, that is the good thing about the Premier League. For all the kind of sort of cloud of inanity and the hype and the nonsense around it, yeah, that was a guy born in January 2000 making his first start. Who was brilliant. I mean, I don't know if he'll get a more accommodating pair of central defenders. They look really slow and tired and turning. Did you see Alderweireld trying to close him down for the second goal? That was painful. But he was brilliant, and good luck to him.
The Tweeting Seagull says, look, Aaron Connolly became the first player born in the 2000s to score a Premier League brace. My question to the panel is, like most Brighton fans on Saturday, what moment has made you both euphoric and depressed at the same time? Hugo Lloris dislocated his elbow. Like, if we're really brutal about this, will Spurs miss him? You feel they will, but I'm not sure how good he's been.
It's not like you've lost the world's greatest goalkeeper. Gazzaniga also made a mistake for the second goal, but a minor mistake. That's not their problem. Missing Hugo Lloris isn't the issue. It's there's just a major problem with the defence. I mean, you saw the thing about Connolly's second goal that was really similar to one scored by Serge Gnabry on Tuesday night. And people were wondering, they asked Graham Potter afterwards, he was asking the press conference, did you study that movement and try to recreate exactly what happened there? And he was very funny. He said, no. His quote was, we don't say to our players, yeah, be Bayern Munich players. but it wasn't a coincidence. It's because there's a very slow defender trying to backtrack, and quick, skillful attackers will exploit the same weakness. And yeah, there's major problems if you don't replace parts of your team.
Barry, what should Pochettino do?
Resign. He won't, because he'd miss out on a payoff. But in my opinion, he should have left during the summer. He clearly doesn't really want to be there. The players aren't listening to him anymore. I think if he leaves, he'll leave with his reputation completely intact and untarnished, and he will get a job at... if I was him, I would leave, take a holiday, maybe till the end of the season, and then take my pick of the many very attractive job offers that would come my way in the summer.
And if he did do that, what should Spurs do? The names being touted are Mourinho, Allegri, Howe.
I mean, I guess Allegri is the one. But I mean, I don't know, I always think this is sort of an interesting thing, because in the vast majority of businesses, you have this brilliant executive who's done sensationally well over 5-6 years, and he has a dip. You don't sack him at the first dip. But football's mentality is, mm-hmm, when there's a dip, you sack him. And Barry may well be right that Pochettino's sort of thought it's run its course, and he may want out, in which case, yeah, there's no point trying to keep it going. But if he does still sort of feel some affinity to Spurs, and if he does sort of think there is something there worth salvaging, then Spurs should do everything they can to keep him, and they should say, look, whatever budget it takes, you can have over the next 2 years to clean this squad out. You look at great managers of the past. Loads of them had dips. Dips that would have got them sacked in the modern game. Look at Shankly. Between his two great teams, they were getting knocked out of the FA Cup by Watford. You know, the process of renewal is the hardest thing in management, and Ferguson was a genius at it. Lobanovsky was a genius at it. But really, you know, I think, you know, you look at every financial metric, and Spurs are either sixth or seventh in the Premier League. I mean, you know, some of them are not, I think it's, if you look at player amortization plus wages, they're behind Everton. So for them consistently to be, if not necessarily finishing third, at least in most people's estimations, the third best team in the country, is actually incredible. And we've kind of maybe started to take that for granted a bit. But that's something that's held together by this peculiar magic of Pochettino's tactics and his personality. And once that starts to go, there's not really anywhere to go back until you refresh those players. And that's where they're at now. And they're really paying the price for the sum of not signing anybody, not doing any refurbishment work.
Stat from Richard Jolly, Premier League goals since August. 2, Aaron Connolly, Aaron Cresswell, Adama Traore, Jeff Hendrick, N'Golo Kante, Ricardo Pereira, and Manchester United. they lost 1-0 at Newcastle. You were there, Jonathan. Steve Bruce's first win as a manager against Manchester United at the 23rd attempt. Matty Longstaff, I mean, what a moment for him. Getting the winner from 25 yards after hitting the bar in the first half. Handed the Man of the Match award by his older brother, Sean. He said, getting to play with Sean today and to score in front of the Gallagate, the fans singing my name, it's all a bit surreal. In a lovely interview on Sky Sports, Matty said he was over the moon, and Sean said he was over the moon. Wilson, you were there. I mean, it's what a wonderful moment.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw the shot of his their dad in the stands. I mean, what a moment for him. But, you know, there was something... the United team I saw flash up on Twitter, and I wasn't sort of paying much attention. I sort of glanced at it. My initial thought was, Christ, that's a shit bench. And I was like, hang on, De Gea's there, Maguire's there, and there's 11. Oh, my God, that's the team. and then saw that Bruce had gone back to this 5-4-1/3-4-3, playing the two local kids in the middle of midfield. And you sort of think that's just the trick that somebody like Steve Bruce, who is local, can pull off, particularly against this down-and-look side. So your narrative has this weird power in football. And so I literally said to somebody, this has got 1-0 Newcastle, Longstaff 71 written all over. So I was a minute out, and I didn't name the Longstaff. But that game was so clear what was going to happen. And I've never felt so certain once the goal went in that especially United weren't going to get back. So even when they had that free kick at the end, sort of 3 or 4 yards outside the box, it's sort of, okay, there's only two things that can happen here. Either it gets dragged wide of the near post or it gets hit in the wall, and it gets hit in the wall. United were utterly, utterly pitiful. So, yeah, great day for the Longstaffs. But I think that is definitely in the conversation for the third worst Manchester United performance since the war.
Okay.
what are the other two?
Yeah. Well, okay, the one that I think stands out above all others is Franco Farrell's last game as manager, which also led to George Best being sacked, although he wasn't in the team. He'd been reinstated on the Friday, which caused a whole load of... He'd been accused of assaulting someone in a nightclub. He'd been suspended. He was brought back on the Friday. The rest of the squad were sort of furious at this because they were like, this guy never lifts a finger. Why are we inviting him back? They lost 5-0 at Crystal Palace, who were 22nd of 22 teams in the First Division. United were 21st at the time. And O'Farrell gets sacked and Best gets sacked the following Tuesday. So that, I think, remains the nadir. Even though they got relegated after that, at least with the relegated side, there was a sense that some kind of rejuvenation was in process. The other game, and to be honest, I'd have to look back at the game to see just how badly they played, is the last season that began this badly was 30 years ago. It was 89-90. And the eighth game of that season, so the equivalent game to this, the season was longer then, they lost 5-1 at City.
I remember.
It's a game when Ferguson famously went home and...
Mark Hughes scored a really good volley, but it was...
Yeah, but that only counts for one, annoyingly.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Ferguson famously just went home, put his head under the pillow and didn't come out of his room for 36 hours or whatever. So I definitely the Palace game in 72, I think, is worse. Maybe that game in 89. And there might be other candidates, but it's up there because...
But there were some terrible games towards the end of the Mourinho time. There was the defeat at Liverpool, which really just felt like...
At Liverpool.
End. Yeah. Well,
this is a Newcastle side... With the fans in open revolt, with a manager who, even seven games in, is already talking about, is this the end for Bruce? Playing two brothers in the middle of midfield who've started 12 Premier League games between them.
I'll tell you what, though, that Matty Longstaff, there's a lot of people sort of bang on about young players constantly, as though to be young is a virtue in itself. Whereas there's a thing about being a good young player as well. He actually looks really properly good, doesn't he? I mean,
him and his brother were both excellent.
He looks like he can do anything. That goal, if you look at him scoring the goal, he knows it's going in before he kicks the ball. You can see him almost celebrating. The way he hits the ball it's just like, I've got this habit at home of booting tennis balls against the skirting board. I'm really good at it. Really, very good. There's a little mark I've made. And he kicks that ball exactly the same way I kick the ball. And that's on his Premier League debut.
Do you exude the joy that he exuded every time you hit that
confidence in my arena.
Skirting board.
But it reminded me of the other day I was showing one of my kids. They obviously Messi's first ever goal. What was his first ever goal? And you remember the goal? It was Ronaldinho dink the ball over the top, and he scores with this cushioned little dink over the goalie in his first game as a 17-year-old. That's like he's playing in the living room. It's ludicrously confident, and obviously he's not Messi, but there was a similar total confidence in, I know exactly what's going to happen here. I've done it millions of times, and I'm really good. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, the thing I find really, I don't quite know what the significance of this is, but United tried to sign Sean Longstaff in the summer for $30 million. And when that story broke, my reaction was, that's just Edward was heard of a young English player. Let's go and sign him. Sean Longstaff had not played any England representative games, hadn't played under-16s, under-17s, under-18s, nothing. So given how good they both appear, how have they never played for England? What's going on there? How is that possible?
Is there some sort of... Southern bias?
I don't know.
I mean I know in Ireland, back in the days when I used to play, it was very Dublin-centric when it came to picking underage national teams. Not that I was ever even remotely in contention.
They didn't get to Burr.
They never made it to Burr. But I do remember, I think Roy Keane has spoken about it, him down in Cork and other Cork players were ignored at the expense of inferior Dublin players because it was a very Dublin-centric selection policy.
I'd be really surprised if that were the case. I think all the work the FA's done on England DNA and all of that should mean it's much more integrated.
I suppose we just don't know how they matured as footballers.
Sure. I just find it really interesting that he hasn't had that recognition.
I hosted some corporate thing in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong Sevens, where teams bring out their under 23 sides, under 21 sides, and Matty Longstaff was there like this summer, and they don't, you know, no one near the first team does that. So it's possible that he has, you know, had a spur in all sorts of parts of his career, but he did look great.
What I loved about his celebration was it started off very kind of cocky, kind of just arms spread, jogging.
And then he realised.
By the time he gets out of the Gallagher, you have his tears pouring down his face, the rain like lashing this tear-stained face. And I thought Andy Carroll's reaction was lovely as well. Yeah. Andy Carroll was the first one to him, and Andy Carroll was sort of grinning and pointing at him because Andy Carroll obviously knows what it means.
Mm. Justin Morehouse tweeting, I can think of 9 people called Fred I'd rather see in United's midfield, and 2 of them are serial killers.
Yeah, I saw that. I couldn't work out who the second serial killer is.
No, I don't know, but I mean, Fred is an inch. Just imagine that they picked out some highlights of him not being very good at football. And it doesn't always work at some clubs, and sometimes you have to go somewhere else. And maybe you don't need to single out Fred, because there are a lot of Manchester United players who aren't very good. But
well, yeah, I mean, the poverty of performance yesterday, Marcus Rashford had 21 touches in the game.
One touch in the Newcastle area.
Which is 4 fewer than Marcus Rocco, who came on in the 60th minute. At half-time, Dubravka had twice as many touches as Rashford. Juan Mata, theoretically the most creative of United's midfield, touched the ball twice in the final third. The two wingers, Pereira and James, attempted 5 crosses between them. None of them hit their target.
Was it in your piece where you say, you know, that there is a real danger of putting young players in to say, look, we want to build on youth without, you know, and basically letting them sink in this terrible environment, stodgy environment.
That was my column last week, mentioned that you compare how Daniel James, he's obviously started really well, scored 3 great goals, it looked very exciting, very good. You compare how he is being treated, that he plays every game, compared to, say, when Giggs came through or when Lee Sharp came through and they'd score a brilliant goal and you wouldn't see him for a month. And I think that's really worrying. And I think the problems Rashford's having, you saw how frustrated he was, how there were times when he'd make a run, wouldn't get the... I mean, there's one in the second half when he got the ball on the left, he cut in field, actually looked quite good for pretty much the only time in the game, slipped a pass into Pereira, made this run beyond the fullback, just needed it knocked back into his path, and it's on his right foot. It's a nice angle to bend in the far post. And Pereira, for some reason, lets the ball run across his body and goes in field. And you sort of saw how, after that, what's the point?
Mm.
And I think the way that he had all that sort of excitement and expectation 2 or 3 years ago, and now he's essentially the most senior forward, and he's not getting any help from anybody, and he just looks, he looks shot.
This is from Colin Miller. Since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was appointed manager of Manchester United, Liverpool have won the same number of games as United have won points in the Premier League.
Well, and also he's had 17 league games in charge in which he's taken 17 points. Jose Mourinho's last 17 games brought 26 points.
Their longest winless run on the road since 1989. Barry, if you were installed as director of football at Manchester United, who are you getting rid of? Or perhaps the shorter answer is, who are you keeping?
It's a tricky one. There's an awful lot of blame to go around for the mess that Manchester United are in. Solskjaer is certainly culpable, but not as culpable as his employers. I imagine he will get sacked sooner rather than later. It'd be a harshish decision, but...
27th November, I predicted. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, I mean, and let's be clear, it wouldn't be a harsh decision at all. I mean, it was a ludicrous appointment. He wasn't qualified for the job, and he's done very badly. But you're right, that's not exactly his fault.
I felt really sorry for him yesterday, actually. He looks awful.
Ed Woodward should not have any say over footballing matters at that club. He's failed on numerous occasions to adequately replace Sir Alex Ferguson. Obviously, that's, big boots to fill, but there's no coherent transfer policy. His decision to appoint Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in the first place was probably a sackable offence. It's turned out to be a ridiculous decision. That didn't need to be taken. You know, he was in charge till the end of the season. Apparently they wanted Maurizio Pochettino, and they should have done that. You know, left Ole in charge till the end of the season, then said, thanks very much, off you go, and got Pochettino from Tottenham.
And the irony is they might have screwed Tottenham as well by doing that. If Tottenham had a full summer to find the appointment they wanted, and yeah, it would have freshened things up. And that United win over PSG,
the penalty that should never have been,
is
right?
Sort of, yeah, that VAR penalty has just destroyed kind of a, it's destroyed Neymar's career with PSG, it's destroyed Tottenham, and it's destroyed Manchester United. It's the most costly penalty decision in the history of football.
Do you not think Man United are doing us all a big favour though? I mean, it's very interesting because we keep hearing about they need to buy more players. You know, they have bought quite a lot, they've spent a lot of money in headline terms, and yet the whole thing is horrible, incoherent mess. And it's just a brilliant reminder that there is more to every area of life than simply having and spending lots of money. And football seems to be really struggling to process this. Why isn't that rich person happy? You know, that's a very old, it's the kind of question you'd find in the Bible, isn't it? Well, why isn't money everything? Well, because there are other things like care and intelligence and wanting to be doing this thing together. And what's missing there is not spending money. You know, people have tried desperately and in haphazard fashion to spend money. It's intelligence, care, love, being involved in that project properly. It's a brilliant lesson that we should all heed and watch endlessly on a loop.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do the rest of the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Some live shows for us. October the 30th, we've sold out Football Weekly versus Science at the Science Museum. Me, you, Barry, Nicky Bandini, and you, Barney, and some sciencey guests. You're looking forward to it?
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to being in the Natural History Museum surrounded by dinosaurs, stuffed animals and extinct species, as well as all the exhibits.
Yeah, and next door we'll be in the Science Museum with the dynamos. Last chance to see Football Weekly in London this year. Me, you, Wilson, you, Barry and Ellis James playing the O2. And then 20th of December, the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds, me, Lars and a couple of others. And the 27th of January...
Me?
Are you doing Leeds?
Oh, I've been asked to do it. I said yes.
Okay, there we go.
Dropped.
Breaking news.
Just others.
You are. Yeah.
Why does Lars get billed ahead of me? It doesn't even work for the Guardian.
I just read what's said on the screen. Me, Lars, and two others.
No, I stand the pecking order.
One of them may be Jonathan Wilson. You can't do that anecdote again. You've done it in Leeds.
No, I've retired.
Oh, you've retired it. Thank God for that.
I've got a shorter one now.
Oh, it better be. 27th of January, me, Barry, plus two others. I presume Wilson's in that one as well.
No, it's in Dublin. I've been banned from Dublin because I do too many other events there.
Oh, are you banned? Oh, you're banned.
So if anyone comes to the Blizzard event
in
Dublin.
No, blah, blah.
Burnley, December 9th.
Burnley won Everton 0. Four defeats in a row for Everton. Where on the Solskjaer-Pochettino scale would you put Marco Silva's current crisis, Barry?
I suppose as far as Everton fans are concerned, they'd have it right up there. I find it very hard to, you know, see Manchester United get beat by Newcastle. It's like, ooh, that's interesting. Or City getting beaten by Wolves. That's interesting. Burnley beating Everton doesn't really do it for me. I don't see it as that much of an upset because I've kind of come to expect Everton to be occasionally quite good, but generally pretty average to quite poor. And so it's come to pass this season. As far as I know, Everton fans are getting very impatient, and I don't blame them for being impatient.
Do you think, Barney, that the lot of the Everton fan is one of the most painful in the relentlessness of the hope and the lack of achievements?
I remember the great Everton team of the mid-80s, which really was a great team. But they, it's a good club. They have a wonderful ground. You go and watch there, it's brilliant. I mean, the reason they're unhappy now is because they have actually spent a bit of money on players and have some good players. Marco Silva is a strange manager in many ways. How we all laughed at Paul Merson when he suggested it was a sort of odd thing to bring Silver into it became a kind of, you know, leave versus remain kind of thing. Look at Merson. But Marco Silva's record in England is really doesn't recommend him particularly for any of these jobs. He's very good at standing on the touchline, looking cinematically worried about things.
He's good in a super slow-mo.
Yeah, he has he's a brilliant range of facial expressions, and he's a sort of handsome, interesting-looking man. But that seems to be his most obvious qualification for his constant rise up the... I mean, presumably he'll get the Man United job next. I mean, obviously, sometimes his teams... I've seen some of his teams play brilliant football and it's fun to watch, but there's obviously an issue with organising them at the other end. And he seems to be under pressure yet again.
You say that. I mean, it was a lovely finish from Jeff Hendrick, but he was totally unmarked. And it was the second time he had that chance.
Well, and Michael Keane pointed at him, went, there's Jeff Hendrick about to score, yeah? And sure enough, there he did.
So it was more observation than doing anything
else.
Certainly
wasn't defending.
Well, the thing I found slightly perplexing about that was Michael Keane saw him, pointed at him, and I was sort of thinking, well, why didn't you go and mark him? Because I'm not sure Michael Keane was marking anyone else.
Well, I mean, I guess because Michael Keane's job in the zone was to occupy the middle of a six-yard box. Yeah. But, I mean, it's one of these sort of weird blind spots of punditry. That if you, oh, yeah, zonal marking's failed again. It's just bad zonal marking. Like, you don't leave a space at the back post. And yet Everton consistently do, and that's why they've let in six goals from set pieces this season.
That is one of two things that always happen now in punditry. The zonal marking, blah, 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 that's the easy thing. The other one is, we freeze them here. Look, there's no pressure on the ball. Alan Shearer does this every time. Of course there's no... You don't run constantly. And obviously, just before someone scores a goal, there's not often someone next to them. So he'll look at them here. Look at them here. Look at the space. I'm going to ring the space around. Do you spend a football match constantly man-marking the other team? No, you don't. But that seems to be the go-to thing. And as though you've produced the rabbit from the hat, teams should constantly man-to-man mark at all stages, or they're failing in some dramatic way that we can point out.
I was having a coffee the other day, and from the restaurant opposite, which of the Fiennes is it that plays Voldemort? Is that Joseph Fiennes? And Michael Palin walked out of the restaurant at the same time, and I pointed because I was so... That was two very famous people. Do you think Michael Keane hadn't spotted Jeff Hendrick? And that was the first time he'd seen him and was just pointing to say, oh, look, that's Jeff Hendrick there. What's he doing?
I mean, you'd hope Michael Keane, who's been a pretty consistent fixture in England squads, didn't get starstruck by, with the greatest respect to Jeff Hendrick.
Be very careful what you say next.
A moderately gifted Ireland international.
See, it's Michael Keane's problem, is he's surprised by seeing other Premier League footballers. So normally enduring Premier League football matches. In his day-to-day life, it's okay. He just points and goes, oh, look. But actually, when he's actually on the pitch, it's a problem. Rafe Fiennes.
I think it's a Rafe, yeah.
It's a Rafe, isn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, I heard him being interviewed on the Mayo and Kermode film show, and he was plugging the Harry Potter movie, but he clearly hadn't seen it and had zero interest in the role. And they were asking about various spells and this and that. And yeah, he just hadn't a clue what the plot of the movie was or anything. I thought it was quite admirable.
To Carrow Road, Norwich 1, Villa 5, Villa's first away points of the season. Norwich had a lot of injuries. We've given them praise for playing out from the back this season. Should we criticise them for doing the same thing when it doesn't work?
Again, I sort of heard that criticism, and I just sort of think it's a bit of a... It's almost a category error. You know, it's not that playing out from the back is bad or good. It's, are you doing it well or not? And here, they're doing it really badly, and having got caught a couple of times, there probably should have been something that kind of clicked in their heads that said, yeah, maybe this isn't working, maybe we should try something different. And I think one of the problems, this might be because of the injuries, was the way they were playing out from the back was very regimented. So it was very easy for Villa to interrupt those passing lanes. So it's not that passing out from the back is bad or good. Do you do it well or not? And here they did it really badly. And Villa, you know, had obviously done their homework and closed them down really well.
It started to feel a bit Spurs-Bayern, and every time Villa kicked it, it went in.
Yeah, there were some really, really good goals. I mean, it was really good to watch. I kind of, I've always associated Villa with the, so it's really distracting. Behind your head, there's this kind of conference going on across the way in a glass-walled room. And all the people in it have been looking over here sort of longingly, as though this looks really fun. And what they're doing is involves PowerPoint presentations. And that I keep catching their eyes as I'm doing, they think, oh, it looks so much fun. There's Barry's there and everything.
Should we all just burst out laughing and hold our sides? I don't believe it.
But they've got fear of missing out. But yeah, no, I mean, it was great for Villa. And when they go forward like that, they look brilliant.
How good is Jack Grealish? Because we've made the point before that it's difficult to play that role in a side that don't have the ball and don't create chances. He looked like there, suddenly he was, you know, absolutely tremendous, sort of Madison-like.
I think
the way
he plays. He's really good. He's a really good player. He's really good at beating a man and then doing something with the ball. But he's not good in a way that means he has to leave that club. You know, the idea that you can have a player that good at your club is something I really like. And it doesn't mean he has to go and play for Spurs. I mean, we also mentioned people like Letizia, but he's not the only good player who stayed at a club he wanted to be at. So he's great. But can he just stay at Villa and be good there?
I really like Wesley. His
sadness at scoring goals.
Well, the first goal, his sort of non-reaction made sense because I think he might have thought he was offside and his first reaction was to look at the linesman. But then he did exactly the same with the second one. So it's almost like he sort of was like, did I used to play for Norwich? I better not celebrate just in case. Well, maybe I'll play for Norwich in the future. I'd like to come back here. Oh, yeah, I won't celebrate.
Barry, you were excited to see Prince George celebrating the work of an Irishman.
Yeah, it was nice to see a royal forelock being tugged in appreciation of Conor Hourihan's fine effort. Hourihan has now become the second Irishman after our friend Kevin Kilbane to score in all four divisions and for his country.
Oh, well done him. Producer Jonathan says, weren't these the two teams when there was a player who didn't want to celebrate because he almost joined the other one? Does anybody remember?
I don't remember that, but I mean, it's good to see mutual respect between sides. Because I mean, Norwich are a very friendly club. You know, Sunderland had this bizarre the friendship trophy with them.
Oh, that's nice.
After they beat us in the Milk Cup final in 85, and because in 85, when everybody was rioting constantly, and because Sunderland fans and Norwich fans didn't riot, we found that, you know, the friendship trophy, so that every time we're in the same division as them, the aggregate score that season, the winners kept the trophy. I think something they've had it for about 3 years out of the last 30-odd. But
A lovely finish from Douglas Luiz to make it 5-0. Last time they scored 5 away from home, a 6-0 win at Derby in 2008. The goal scorers, Ashley Young, John Carew, Stillian Petrov, Gareth Barry, Gabby Agbonlahor and Marlon Harewood. And two nice things to note from Norwich's goal from Joseph Dermich. One was that they played the goal music, which presumably when you're 5-0 down, it's a bit of a letdown. And secondly, that Dermich grabbed the ball out of the net and ran David Platt style, ran back to the centre circle as if the comeback was on.
Maybe I often think that the subs don't seem to be paying attention. So maybe he didn't realise just how serious the situation was.
It's possible. Producer Jonathan writes, it was Wes Houlihan who cruelly turned down Cambridge United after we had him on trial for the whole of pre-season and went to live in Australia. In 2014...
As you pointed out, Max, he had you on
that's
trial.
That's true, yeah.
And at least you know he won't be celebrating against Cambridge now.
That is true, yeah. He almost moved from Norwich to Villa in 2014. He scored against them 6 weeks later and didn't celebrate as a mark of respect for the side he almost joined. West Ham 1, Palace 2. Palace are up to 6th. Joshua says, should we consider Crystal Palace's Everton Cup material, big six or top four contenders, Barney?
Possibly. I mean, they're a well-organised, simple team with a good manager. And they're also a team who feel sort of historically right, Crystal Palace. There's some sort of stat that something like 5% of all current English Premier League players come from the Croydon Triangle. And even though it's really hard to come through that youth system and get into the Premier League, so you can't expect it to happen all the time, there's a lot of really good footballers down there who are sort of coming through. And yeah, it's right. It's our Catalonia.
Is the Croydon Triangle, is that stemming the pathway for Geordies? Is that the problem that they...
Well, County Durham has produced more England internationals historically than any other county.
And what are the three points of the Croydon Triangle?
The Sainsbury's at Selhurst Park.
The A23.
That Chinese restaurant on the Purley Way?
Yeah, I did do this. I did an article about this. The Croydon Triangle, the concrete Catalonia, exists.
Oh.
But a bit like the North East, a lot of those players, because the thing about that is those players tended to go to other clubs and come through rather than playing for Newcastle, Sunderland. Most Premier League teams have someone from Croydon in them. And good luck to them.
I like the fact Crystal Palace have 2 points fewer than City, but a goal difference 18 worse.
Well, that's because City used up their goals against Watford, didn't they? Should have saved a few of them. Now, we've spoken about VAR, Barney, and about how it spoils the emotion of a celebration. But when it works like this, turning a non-goal into a goal, doesn't it make it more exciting for Roy and for Ayu?
I guess so. As long as it works properly and the rules are applied in a sensible way, I'm perfectly happy. I'm sure we'll all get over this, the VAR outrage and the problem with these lines that don't seem to be lines. I worry about Roy having that much excitement, though.
He's so giveable when he celebrates. If you haven't seen it, basically there was a header down and I was flagged offside, but he was onside and the goal was not given immediately, but then was given later. I could watch Roy Hodgson on the touchline just for hours and hours and hours. It's tremendous fun. But do you think that we kind of underrate him because he's got that sort of comedy-ness about him?
Yes.
I think I do.
And also because the bulk of his early success was outside of Britain at a time when we just didn't learn about stuff that was happening in football outside of Britain.
True. The penalty, Patrick Van Aanholt, I hadn't noticed that Milivojevic wasn't on the pitch. He got his fifth yellow of the season last weekend. First league minutes he's missed since the 23rd of December, 2017.
Did you notice he did a West Ham gesture when he scored?
Yeah.
I don't know what that was about. He did that kind of cross thing that they do.
Is that a come and get me plea?
To hammer us.
Oh, yeah, it's the ultimate respect for the other team when you've scored, isn't it? Presumably it means something else as well as I love West Ham.
Who knows?
Yarmolenko did do one of them last week, but looked very kind of unconvinced by what he was doing. Mm. He'd obviously seen teammates do it. That looks... what is it? I'm not sure, but it's something like that.
Have you noticed the... sorry, this is a Millwall reference. I don't know if you've noticed
that.
Danny Dyer, well-known West Ham fan.
Yes.
Promoting his new show, which is called The Wall. So there are all these great moments of him standing in front of this massive thing called The Wall, trying to look tough and, very excited about The Wall. Which
is it a Millwall-based show, or is it about sort of people climbing walls like gladiators?
No idea. Oh. But it looks complex, and I will not find out what it's about, but Millwall fans have found that.
Yeah, I was on the Real Football Factories. I had no idea what the programme was. Got asked to... Be a talking head. Can you come and talk about the football and the Balkan Wars? And we'll give you, 100 quid, 150 quid. Yeah, all right, fine. So I turn up, dressed as a geography teacher as usual, in this kind of corduroy jacket, and I'm giving this sort of long kind of socioeconomic explanation of the issues. And I never saw the programme. And then a mate of mine from home... was stoned out of his head, lying on his couch one in the morning, and it came on, and he had to go back and check it the next day because he couldn't quite believe he wasn't hallucinating. Rang me up and said, did you know you were on this program? So, oh yeah, I vaguely remember doing that.
So and Danny Dyer is the host, is he?
Totally incongruous. Danny Dyer kind of, there's a bit where he goes to Belgrade and he sees Cyrillic writing for the first time and he goes, what even is that? It's like alien writing. And he's standing in front of the Ethnographic Museum in Belgrade. And ethnographic is one of those words which, although a long word, looks pretty similar in Cyrillic to English. What does that say? It says ethnographic, Danny. I mean, I'm not sure you'd understand it if it was just like... And then, there's me cropping up as an incongruous geography teacher.
No, Dyer and Wilson is a partnership I would happily see again. To St Mary's, Southampton 1, Chelsea 3. Fred says, is Chelsea's improvement in form due to Frank Lampard adding mirrors to the collective car, or a case of the witch's curse returning to haunt Wilson's prophecy that Lamps will always be a limited manager because he was a crap midfielder? One for Barney?
Well, no, hang on.
I'd say one for Wilson.
The defending issues haven't gone away. They kept one clean sheet this season. Yeah, they've scored 12 goals in the last three away games, which is great, and they look fantastic going forward. They've let in 5 goals in that time, and those 3 games they've been against Norwich, against Southampton, who haven't won at home this season, and against the Wolves side, who at that point were without a win this season. So they're still really vulnerable at the back. Although they ended up being comfortable winners yesterday, and did look great going forward. Southampton had two or three good chances in the first half to get it back to 2-2. They're still really flaky at the back, and when they come up against top-class opposition, such as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Manchester United, they're liable to concede four. And that a team that scored 19 goals in the last 23 games, four of them against Frank Lampard's don't-look-back Chelsea.
So you're saying even though it looks good, it's not actually good?
Well, they're very good going forward, and there is excitement, there is youth there, and that's nice and it's great. It's not going to win them anything.
Well, I think they're in that. One interesting thing about them is that even though he's playing these young players because he sort of has to, those young players are actually good rather than just young, which is an interesting break from
the Solskjaer tradition.
I really do think that Mason Mount is a really
tremendous good player, isn't he?
And Abraham as well. Is I don't know why he didn't get a chance before to play at Chelsea, because he's a proper good centre forward.
Mind, it helps when Southampton keeper gone. I mean, it was exactly the same as the Bournemouth game, wasn't it? Just a bouncing ball. Oh my God, what did I? Oh no.
Yeah, Willian is playing really well as well, isn't he? A sort of player that I don't think I've really ever spent a long time appreciating.
I'm a big fan of Willian. I mean, he has one move where he jinks inside and smacks it as hard as he can. But he's a great classic Brazilian that every team should have. He'll keep running forever. He's very sort of enthusiastic, good team man. Big fan of Willian.
Yeah, I loved him at Shakhtar, and I'm glad that... I think he's been very good for Chelsea. I'm glad he's sort of finally getting some...
Well, maybe a beneficiary of Hazard moving on, in that you're always going to be in his shadow at Chelsea because, he's fantastic. And maybe Willian's feeling the benefit there.
Christian Pulisic did something nice as well, didn't he, to set up Batshuayi? It's been a tricky time for him. And without wanting to just turn to you for yogurt pots for hats, Barry, Dan says, do you reckon Paul Tierney shampoos his arms more than Barry shampoos his hair?
I have no idea. I was slightly distracted from the Chelsea game by Sky really messed that one up yesterday. They're limited in what they can show, but they showed the wrong two games yesterday, didn't they? I was more concerned with what was going on at the game I couldn't see than the game I could.
Well, I think they got one right. The Newcastle United game, I was happy to have on the telly.
Yeah, I mean, they ended up being three good games of the weekend, or interesting games of the weekend, maybe rather than good games. Newcastle v Manchester United was one of them, but not getting Liverpool Leicester in retrospect looks a bit of an odd decision.
It does,
but
that's life, eh?
It's nice having football you can't see. It's a reminder of the good old days.
The best football is football you can't see.
Yeah.
That should be the tagline.
It's like the best players are the ones that are sidelined with injury.
Well, it's like that Jan Molby goal that nobody saw for years, that everybody said was the greatest goal ever scored, and then people were recreating it on computer games, and then some footage eventually emerged. And I mean, I'm not saying it was a tap-in, but I mean, I doubt it was the best goal Liverpool scored that week, let alone being the goal of the century.
Right. Arsenal 1, Bournemouth 0. Arsenal are third. North London is red after this scratchy win over Bournemouth. David Luiz with a lovely glancing header, although Callum Wilson could have done better, couldn't he? And he had a big chance at the start of the second half, and Bournemouth had a few chances. It wasn't, I wouldn't call it a modern-day classic, but how enthused should Arsenal fans be?
Well, what I don't understand about Emery is he came in saying he was going to play this hard-pressing game, and he was going to get them fit and going to get them organised in a way that maybe they hadn't been in late period Wenger. And there were some signs of that yesterday, then they backed off in the second half. And I don't understand the inconsistency of that approach. Why sometimes they look like they're pressing hard and sometimes they sort of look very dilatory about it. I don't know if they're trying to sit deep at times and the forward players are still pressing when maybe they should be dropping off. But that organisation doesn't seem quite right at the moment. But in the first half, I think, whether it was them being good or Bournemouth being bad, from what I saw in the highlights, which it's obviously not necessarily a full picture, it looked like their pressing did disrupt Bournemouth. But then the second half, Bournemouth came back into it. So
it's a funny game, isn't it? I mean, if you'd come to Arsenal from pre-modern Arsenal and you just thought, well, what happened to Arsenal? I've been in a coma for 25 years, and you saw 1-0, central defender scored with a header, you'd think, oh, well, Arsenal haven't changed. who's this David Luiz bloke? He's probably a bit like Steve Ball.
Proper no-nonsense. Yeah.
David Lewis.
David Lewis.
Long-haired Welsh centre-back.
It's a classic Arsenal result, and well, the outline all looks classically Arsenal, but achieved with weird ingredients.
In the Football League, big shock at the top of the Championship. Bottom side Stoke got their first win of the season at leaders Swansea. What you want, a division where anyone can beat anyone. The Championship, the best league in the world. Andre Ayew had given the Swans the lead in the first minute. Sam Clucas and then Scott Hogan in the last minute gave some much needed relief for Nathan Jones, with both Ayew scoring at the weekend. It is currently Jordan 3, Andre 4 in that contest. There are new joint leaders, West Brom, who beat Cardiff 4-2, and Nottingham Forest, who won 1-0 at home to Brentford. Surprise package, Preston climb above Swindon after a 5-1 hammering of Barnsley. Barnsley are just 1 point ahead of Stoke at the bottom. Reading fall into the bottom three after Huddersfield won their second game in a row. First time they've done that in the league since February 2018. And Millwall won their first game since Neil Harris left, 2-1 at home to Leeds, who had Gaetano Berardi sent off in the 14th minute when he conceded a penalty for breathing on Tom Bradshaw. Barney, Neil Harris, are you surprised that he left the right time, perhaps?
A little bit surprised, but it probably the right time. The team sort of congealed a bit. But whoever comes in, and possibly that might be Gary Rowett, won't have any money to spend, so it'll be pretty much the same stuff.
Good news for Millwall fans, then. In League One, Ipswich, the only one of the top four to win, the only unbeaten side in England apart from Liverpool. They won 1-0 at third place Fleetwood, 4 points clear of Wickham. Sunderland lost 2-0 at Lincoln. How do you feel about this, Barry Wilson?
I mean, they haven't improved since last season. The problem is, the squad keeps getting bigger, and it's just full of sort of interchangeable mediocre centre-backs and centre midfielders. None of whom seem to be improving what's gone before. Jack Ross seems constantly chopping change between them with no discernible improvement. Plus, the takeover now seems to be on the brink of falling through, which is obviously bad news.
Is it possible that Jack Ross will get sacked during this international break?
Well, I think the takeover would be the first thing. So they, I think before anything else happens, they'll resolve that. There's no point sacking Jack Ross and then new owners come in. You appoint somebody to replace Jack Ross and then new owners come in and then they sack him as well. I think sort of the takeover and then... last season I had sort of sympathy for Ross in that he'd had to do a huge amount of restructuring of the squad, a huge number of players come in. That obviously takes time for them all to gel. But all the problems were there last season are there again this season. Nothing has changed, nothing's improved. So I understand the frustration. I don't think he's right on the edge, but I think things have to improve in the next couple of months.
In League Two, 4 points separate the top seven. Forest Green at the top, Stevenage bottom. They lost at Colchester. Jack Rowles, on loan from Spurs, pinged one from 40 yards for Cambridge, who heroically drew 2-2 at home to Macclesfield. England's women lost 2-1 to Brazil in a friendly at the Riverside Stadium. Manchester United keeper Mary Earps got her first start for the national team in goal for over a year, then let the first of Dabinia's two goals slip under her when it seemed easier to save it. Couldn't do anything about the second, which took a deflection off Steph Houghton and looped over her. Beth England pulled one back with 10 minutes to go with a decent header. That is 4 defeats in 5 for England. Phil Neville said after the game, losing 4 out of 5 games is not acceptable. I don't want to brush around that, but I can take comfort from the way we performed. Barry, you've written a bit about Phil Neville recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I just think he's a bit of a fraud, to be honest. He talks a good game. His team doesn't play a particularly good game, and his record, recent record, is diabolical. Lost 4, drawn 1. And he seems to be absolutely Teflon in that position. It was decided he would be in charge of the Team GB side for the Olympics, before England had even, I think, gone to contest the World Cup, or while they were contesting it. I'm not sure he's the right man for the job.
Does he not get any grace for getting into the semi-finals?
What are they supposed to do? They're the most well-resourced team in the world. They got to the semi-finals last time.
They spent loads more money and performed slightly worse. He has spent... They're probably if not the richest sort of women's national team in the world, certainly the second richest, and he's made them worse since taking over. But someone pointed out to me on Twitter, actually. I thought they made a very good point over the weekend. The England women's team, it seems to be more a marketing project than an actual football project. They're just interested in getting people to games, filling up stadiums anytime they play. Reporters breathlessly report on how many people were at the game. You know, the fact that the team is complete shite doesn't seem to make any difference.
Well, I mean, Phil Neville got the job because he's famous.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. There's no point being around the bush. He didn't get it because he's a great manager. He got it because people know who Phil Neville is. That in itself goes against what sport should be.
All right. Fitbar, Barry, Rangers top of the league.
Yeah, we have a title race in Scotland by the looks of things. Rangers battered Hamilton 5-0 since losing to Celtic four league matches ago. They've won their subsequent four games by an average or an aggregate score of 17-1. Jermaine Defoe got a hat-trick in that one. And if they could only win an Old Firm derby, you'd give them a chance of actually stopping Celtic getting their nine in a row. Celtic lost at Livingston. I saw most of that game and they were really bad. Livingston, better than them in every department, were hungrier and just better. And Celtic had Ryan Christie sent off for a foul on Scott Robinson, formerly of Neighbours. Mm-hmm. He was married to
Charlene Mitchell. Everybody knew that. You didn't.
Mitchell or Ramsey?
Oh, Ramsey, yes.
Charlene Ramsey.
Yes. Mm. I stand corrected.
No, was she not a Mitchell? Because Madge remarried. Or had Madge been a Mitchell and then became a Ramsey?
Where was Mrs. Mangle?
She became a bishop in the end.
Yeah,
ultimately, this is before the marriage to Harold, though.
Well, in the end, she ended up in Emmerdale. I'm not sure who she was in that. But anyway, yes, so exciting times. Oh, and at the bottom of the table, Hearts lost again. And Craig Levein, not for the first time in his career, although I think this was slightly out of necessity, fielded a team with no strikers.
She was a Mitchell.
Okay, thank you, Wilson. Come on. That'll do for part two. Part three will begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks very much. Barcelona beat Sevilla 4-0 in the big game of the weekend. Ended up with nine men. What happened there?
What happened there was, I'm tempted to just say to you, Mateo Laoz happened there. Now, if you just say the words Mateo and Laoz in Spain, everyone immediately knows what you're talking about. This is a referee who I think actually sometimes a little unfairly has always been seen as a man who's desperate to make it about him. And I think that's unfair because at times it's based on the fact that he's just kind of quite personable, that he smiles a lot. And also because what happens, of course, is this becomes self-perpetuating because he's a guy that's kind of a bit smiley, who seems in truth to be inventing the rules as he goes along sometimes. The TV cameras follow him. So, of course, the TV cameras follow him. So he waves at them. So they follow him some more. And the whole thing kind of snowballs and creates this caricature of him. But it is true, as I said, that at times he does seem to be making it up and he does seem to sort of be very, very erratic. So what happens is in the last minute, you've got, I think it's Chicharito Hernandez is running through and he's running alongside Araujo, who's a Uruguayan, 19 year old, making his debut for Barcelona at centre back. He runs alongside Chicharito. There's a very, very slight tug of the shirt. They then carry on running. There's an arm against it, shoulder to shoulder, basically. And Chicharito goes down on the edge of the area. It's not inside the area, so it's not a penalty. If it is a foul, it's pretty light. And Mateo Laoz runs over and gets the red card out and sends him off. Direct red. At which point, Dembélé comes running into the crowd of people having a go at the referee, or at least saying things to the referee, and says, muy malo, very bad, and gets sent off for that as well. And actually, the referee's report confirms this. It's not like he's claiming that he said anything particularly offensive. He didn't call him any rude names. So he came over to me and with his arms gesturing said, muy malo. What I liked about this, of course, this is Dembélé, and there's all these questions, and there have been all these questions for the last 2 years about his integration in the team and so on. And Valverde was asked after the game, the Barcelona manager, what Dembélé had said. And he said, well, it's a mystery because you're going some to get a phrase out of him in Spanish at all. He said, so it can't have been very long, whatever it was. So it's nice to know that he's learned how to say muy malo. They also then showed some footage on Spanish TV last night of a conversation between Suarez and Mateo Laoz. Now, of course, Luis Suarez is a person who does give referees quite a lot of jip quite a lot of the time. But there's a moment when there's a foul given against him and Suarez says, I slipped. And Mateo Laoz does this kind of challenging stare, to which Suarez says, what, can't we talk? And he says, no. Anyway, as they're walking up the pitch, Suarez clearly says something to him along the lines of, but why not? And he says, listen, don't make mistakes, Luis. To which Luis Suarez turns to him and says, don't you make mistakes either. And of course, he does. He cocks it up, which is kind of what happens.
Like the Spanish Mike Dean. Did it feel like a 4-0?
No, not at all. And that's the weird thing about this game. So, I know this doesn't prove anything, right? But I'll tell you what my notebook says.
Right.
My notebook from last night's game says, De Jong, good saves, Ter Stegen. Then it says, oh, great chance, De Jong. Then it says, what a miss, De Jong. And then it says, Barcelona are 3-0 up. And that's kind of what happened. That Sevilla. Oh, look, Barcelona 3-0 up. 7.5 minutes it took Barcelona to score 3 goals, right? And obviously, if you factor in celebrations, piss-balling about, VAR reviews, which there were, I think, on at least one of the 3 goals, 7.5 minutes to score 3 goals, you're really going some. And Sevilla have been the better side, and suddenly they're in this position where they think, blimey, it's gone, 3-0 down. Luke de Jong missed 3 really good chances. He then hit the post with an even better chance at 3-0 down for 4-0, which would have made it 3-1, rather. And there's been a really kind of clear sense post-game, even from the Barcelona manager, who said, look, the truth is that score was too big for the way the game was. It shouldn't have happened like that. Of this sense that Sevilla have a really big problem up front. Luke de Jong hasn't scored yet this season. He's had more shots than anyone else without any goals. I think it's 19 or 18 this year. And this is a Seville team, obviously, as you know, kind of a new project. They bought 13, 14 players in the summer. And that's the one big gaping hole in the team. I quite like the way one of the Spanish papers put it. They said, Luke de Jong had 3 chances and scored none of them. Luis Suarez had no chances and scored one of them.
Meanwhile, a standing ovation for Gareth Bale in a 4-2 win for Real Madrid over Granada.
Yeah, he played very well. He produced a really gorgeous assist for the opening goal from Karim Benzema. And I think it just tells you more than anything else just about the way that the situation has become slightly normalised. Now, obviously, there's some residual bitterness. Bale himself is, you know, still not happy about the way things were handled in the summer, the way things went. But the bottom line is he's in the team. He's playing almost every game, although he didn't play in midweek, with Zidane claiming that he had a slight knock, which actually wasn't true from Bale's point of view, and he would have happily played in midweek. But, you know, Zidane then puts him straight back in the team. And I think Zidane's mentality is, look, I'm not going to push this guy. I'm not going to risk injuries. I'm not going to play him 2 games in a week. And Bale's playing really, really well. The important thing as well from Madrid's point of view was that Eden Hazard scored his first goal.
Atletico had a goalless draw at Real Valladolid. Great stat from Colin Miller that Sandro Ramirez, on loan at Valladolid from Everton, is without a goal in his last 53 league games across 5 different clubs. He had a first half penalty and kicked it about 3 goals over.
Yeah, have a look at the footage of this. I actually feel a bit sorry for him. Admittedly, I don't feel too sorry for him because, and I'm prepared to be proven wrong, obviously, if the image shows this, I think he dived quite embarrassingly to get the penalty. And I think this is one of the issues with, I mean, this is another long debate for another day maybe, but with the VAR, I certainly thought that VAR would end diving. I think it's doing the opposite, because players now know that if they can get a contact, however minor it is, they're going to get a penalty when it's looked back on. And so he goes looking for a contact. I'm not even sure there is any, but if there is, it's very minor. He's gone looking for it. He gets a penalty and he puts it over the bar. But watch the footage when he puts his left foot down alongside the ball to hit it with his right. I don't know if the turf is slightly loose, but the ball pops up. And so, of course, when he pops it up, his right foot swinging through and gets underneath it and goes way, way, way over the bar. By the way, I think it's more than 53. That's league games. I think it's 59 games in total without a goal. Would it be too cruel? I refer to him in today's piece, which I haven't finished writing yet. So, Max, you can help me on this.
Okay.
Would it be too cruel for me to put the word striker in speech marks?
I'll defer to the experienced writers in the room. Barney? Were you concentrating?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, totally fine. Wilson, happy?
I think you're better than that, Sid.
Well, I'm glad you said that.
I would say lazy journalism.
I am not better than that, obviously. I'm glad you said that, because so far I have taken them out. I decided that wasn't fair.
Good, good. In the game between Real Sociedad and Getafe, a rare occurrence, the linesman flagged the Getafe player offside from a throw-in.
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't
it? Amazing.
I mean, you know, we can. It's not fair how much we have a go at referees sometimes, but when a referee gives an offside from a throw-in, and it's really quite good because you get these Getafe players running up at him doing throw-in gestures, like, you know, genuinely looking as if to say, what the bloody hell is going on inside your mind?
There's a rumour, Sid, David De Gea keen to buy Elche, Spanish second yes. division club, for $16 million. Is any truth in that?
Well, it's been reported here. I can't honestly tell you at this early stage whether or not it's true. I will try and find that out for you. But yes, it is something that's been reported here and would make some sense. They're a club that really need it. I wonder if he should try and get the Níguez family in. Sal Níguez and his two brothers, who all began their careers at Elche and all very kind of, what's the word, very associated with the club.
Sid, I'm just thinking about you putting the word striker in speech marks. Mm. It would be the Twitter equivalent of having a go at, say, Frankie Boyle or David Baddiel for being a so-called speech mark comedian. So,
do you think it? Yeah, that's
definitely
that's
don't
true.
Do it.
I would never use the phrase so-called, though. I don't know what it is about the phrase so-called. It feels very... what's the word?
Shite. Anyway, Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe out in Spain now. In Germany, shock.
What Sid doesn't know is that I'm going to put them in before his article goes up.
In Germany, shocked at the top, Bayern Munich lost 2-1 at home to Hoffenheim. Armenian striker Sargis Adamian, on his first start in the top flight at the age of 26, scored both for the away side, their first win in five. Bayern dropped down to third. Borussia Mönchengladbach are top. They beat Augsburg 5-1 yesterday. Wolfsburg move up to second with a 1-0 win over Union Berlin. Wout Weghorst scored the only goal of the game. Dortmund are all the way down in eighth after drawing with fourth-placed Freiburg, which is a lovely town, by the way. Recommend it for a mini-break. Every team from fourth to ninth drew. From Germany to Italy, where Nicky Bandini gives us her Serie A roundup, starting with last night's match between the top two, Inter and Juve.
Yes, it was the Derby d'Italia this weekend. Inter against Juventus, and a first chance for Antonio Conte to show that his new team was serious about dislodging his old team from their position as perennial champions. Inter came into the game with a perfect record, top of the table, 6 games, 6 wins, and a 2-point lead over Juventus. But they blew their chance to make it 5 points, losing 2-1 at San Siro. That was a fair result. Juventus were the better team, and really we probably ought not to be surprised given the relative depth of the two squads. Juve's second goal was scored by Gonzalo Higuain on an assist from Rodrigo Bentancur, both of them introduced from the bench. The Inter defender, who was caught ball-watching on the goal, was also a substitute. Alessandro Bastoni, who's 20 years old, fresh from his Inter debut last month, and generally not a player with anything like the international experience of those two. So Conte was quick to highlight that disparity after the game, suggesting that Maurizio Sarri, his Juventus counterpart, of course, could cover his eyes and point at any substitute to send on, and he would always end up with something good, which is possibly true. It's also true that two of Inter's changes were forced by injury. Stefano Sensi, who's really been their best player this season, went off after 34 minutes. Diego Godin went off in the second half. He was the player replaced by Bastoni. And the game was only 34 minutes old when Sensi went off. But I would say that Juve was still playing better at that point, even though it was 1-1. And Sarri really did seem to have caught Inter off guard in this game by taking a much more direct approach. The first goal came from a long ball forward from Miran Pjanic in his own half, and Cristiano Ronaldo also hit the crossbar from another such pass from Matthijs de Ligt. So a very interesting and different approach from Sarri to what we're used to. And although Sarri insisted that this means nothing, it means nothing to be top of the table this early in the season, he is definitely starting to get a little bit of his own personality into the team and showing some flexibility as well. No longer wedded to this sort of 4-3-3 that we saw at Chelsea and Napoli. He's adapted to a 4-3-1-2 with a diamond midfield, which initially looked like it was to accommodate Aaron Ramsey behind the attack, and then he actually left Ramsey out of this lineup and started Federico Bernardeschi in that role. So his decision to go with Dybala as well in the starting 11 was also unexpected. And Sarri's just really bucking expectations in general, I think, for a coach who had previously been infamous for this reluctance to rotate. So interesting stuff. Juventus back on top. And Napoli fell further behind as well after drawing at Torino. By the time you hear this, it's also possible that Milan will have a new manager. Marco Giampaolo's team failed to impress even during a win over Genoa, and as of time of recording, imminent change is expected.
Thank you, Nicky. In France, PSG are still top. They beat Angers 4-0. Angers slipped to third. They're having a fun season. 9 games in. They've scored 16, conceded 15. A goal either scored or conceded every 26 minutes. Nantes beat Nice 1-0, their third win in a row, which takes them up to second. Saint-Etienne made their way out of the relegation zone with a 90th-minute winner against Lyon in Le Derby. And after a good start, André Villas-Boas' Marseille are now without a win in 4. They went down 3-1 at Amiens. Dijon have escaped the bottom of the table. They're up to 18th after their second win in 2. Metz the bottom. Most importantly, Rennes 0, Reims 1. Luis Figo is in Guildford, everybody. Have you seen a picture of Luis Figo in Guildford? He says, Guildford time, with a happy emoji. And slightly bizarrely, there's a spaceman walking about 200 yards behind him, totally unreferenced. If you were on Guildford High Street and saw Luis Figo being chased by Neil Armstrong, I hope you had a lovely time. Android Flix says, what is your favourite supermarket?
Tesco on Acre Lane in Brixton, because I know where everything is and it's very handy for doing big shops.
Barney?
What do you think I'm going to say?
I mean, I'm hoping Waitrose.
Yeah, I'd go with Greenwich Waitrose.
Okay, excellent news.
Jonathan? Fulham Sainsbury's.
Okay.
Although I do, you know, I for treats I go to Waitrose.
Okay.
But also, their selection of seeds to put on your breakfast is, I think, first rate.
Is it?
I love their dried cherries.
Excellent.
I really don't understand Wilson's breakfast seed obsession.
Yeah, it's very...
I've never felt the need to put seeds on anything.
Seeds are very energising.
Are they?
Yeah, I recommend it.
Okay.
This could be part of your health kick, Barry.
I'll give him a go. I'm doing big shop tomorrow. I'll stock up on seeds.
When I'm doing the show after Alan Brazil on TalkSport, I always bring him some seeds so he can look at me and say, I'm not a canary. Barbican Waitrose, just to finish that off.
There was some World Health Organization advice recently that everybody should eat 2 handfuls of seeds every day.
Oh. Any particular kind of seeds?
Or mixed seeds. Mm-hmm. But if you really think about that, that's 16 billion handfuls of seeds being consumed every day.
That's a lot of trees I'm getting
by
to grow.
Every human being on the planet, every single day, has got to eat the... I just don't know how...
I mean, 2 handfuls seems a lot. I mean,
yeah, it's a lot.
I have a scattering on my...
That's inadequate.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Barney.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Hey, no. You're welcome anytime.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.